time. Welcome, Lighthouse family, to Biblical Finance. This is in our stewardship series, and we'll get started. So appreciate this opportunity. I get the opportunity to think a lot, but I don't get the opportunity to talk a lot. I'm usually a listener in my household. I don't know about yours, but I want to just briefly go through the last 2 weeks real quick, just to highlight the main takeaways as a foundation to move on into tonight. We need to remember God is the source, and money is just a resource. Money is not good or evil. It's how it's used. We need to trust in the Lord, not in money, not in our bank account. Discipline is probably the main single factor where people don't execute their financial plan. I mean, I don't know how many diets are out there where if that diet's executed, it works. But people that try that diet and it don't work, it's because they don't execute and it's discipline. Well, a financial plan's the same way. We can come up with plans that work, and usually if they don't work, it's because we didn't execute them or didn't have the discipline to execute them. Tithes, we talked about that a lot, and we'll just briefly touch on that as a refresher, is it really helps us attain discipline. And 90% of our money with discipline is going to go a lot further than 100% of our money without discipline. And tithing will help us with that discipline component. And the main things about tithing is, just remember, it's a commandment in the Bible, not a request, it's a commandment. We're to be a cheerful giver. You know, God knows our heart. It's not what we give, it's not how much we give, it's we're giving what the God is in our putting in our heart to give. And it needs to be unconditional. We don't set up a contract with God. You know, I'm going to give this and I'm expecting, you know, 10 times that back in my, you know, within a week. If not, I'm going to be disappointed. May not come to church next week to punish you. Well, you're not going to punish God. You're going to punish yourself. Okay? One thing I haven't talked about before, in error, I guess, but I want to bring it up tonight, is the importance of first fruits. Everything else, you know, we talked about tithing before, but I hadn't really talked about first fruits before. But that's also an important part of tithing. It needs to be the first thing. It needs to be the best. It needs to be the lamb without spot or blemish. If you remember the story of Cain and Abel, one offering was better than the other. We need to make our offerings a good offering. We need to be obedient to the Holy Spirit in all things in our Christian walk. You know, obviously, finances is just part of that, but we need to be obedient in that as well. We shouldn't worry about success. Living in the will of the Lord is the best we can do. It's the ultimate success for us and anyone around us in our relationships. It's the best we can do. Doesn't mean we'll have the best bank account, because guess what? That's not a good measure. The world will use that as a measure, but we all know so many things more important, you know, than money and your blessings. We are meant to, say, pass through our blessings in our giving, to be kingdom-minded. Someone once asked me, what's the best investment you ever made? I had to think about it a while, and I said, giving flowers to Tammy. What? Relationships are worth more than money. Okay? That small amount of money versus the impact it had on a relationship was so one-sided, probably the best investment I ever made. What's your second best investment? Well, I'm not sure, but I'd say it's a kingdom-minded investment that probably didn't add to my balance sheet, probably cost me money. What's your third best investment? Probably still a kingdom-minded investment, didn't add to my balance sheet. You get the gist of what I'm saying. Kingdom-minded investing doesn't necessarily add to your financial wealth. But if you're in the will of the Lord, it's going to have the best return that you can really get. So we talked about some building blocks leading up to putting together a biblical financial plan. First thing, we got to get our priorities straight. Okay, being in touch with the Holy Spirit helps us put everything into perspective in our life, put money in its proper place. It shouldn't be something we lust after. It shouldn't be the number one goal. It has its place. Again, it's just a resource to be used for kingdom purposes the way God is leading us or directing us. It's not the way the world would say. The world says it's a game. You know, kick your competitor in the face or whatever it takes to get to the top, and the guys with the most toys at the end wins. Well, that's the world. And if you look at those people, they're not very happy. I remember many years ago, not recently, but I was in Las Vegas and put 50 cents in the machine, the one arm bandit or whatever, you know. And it's like, wow, I could have bought a Mountain Dew for that. And I got nothing. I did about two or three of those and said, I ain't doing this anymore. And then I looked around at all the people, hundreds of people. They did not look happy. They're smoking. They're doing this. They've been up all night, you know, and it's not happy. I said, that was it for me. Gambling's not a good thing. And when it comes to financial planning, don't make winning the lottery be your retirement plan. That's not what you want to have as your retirement plan. So we need to manage our debt, build a positive cash flow. I talked a little bit last week about the Monopoly game. Really liked that as a kid because it taught you how to invest, in that case, properties, and then developing the properties for higher rents, you know, and building cash flow. And that's what we really want to try to do to manage our resources that we're given is grow them, multiply them. Why? Well, kingdom purpose. For effect, they have use. We can put them to use. We can do good things with them. I want to spend some time today about debt, get into debt a little bit more. It's probably the single most financial thing that people struggle with. And it's front and center because no matter where you're at, you're a business person, you deal with debt, you know, in some way, shape, or form. I first want to read some scriptures. Romans 13:7 says, give to everyone what you owe them. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. And if honor, then honor. Romans 13:8, let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another, for whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. And Luke 7:41-43 says, two people owed money to a certain moneylender. This is Jesus speaking, okay? This would be in red. One owed him 500 denarii and the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back, so he forgave the debts of both. Now which of them will love him more? Simon replied, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt forgiven. You have judged correctly, Jesus said. Of course, he gave us the biggest debt of all with his passing, right? He paid our debt, a debt that we can't pay, the sin debt. Psalm 37:21 The wicked borrows but does not pay back, but the righteous is generous and gives. Proverbs 22:7. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is slave to the lender. Deuteronomy 15:6. For the Lord your God will bless you as he has promised, and you will lend to many nations, but will borrow from none. You will rule over many nations, but none will rule over you. And there's a whole lot more scriptures. I think Jesse said it last week. There's over 2,000 scriptures in the Bible having to do with finance in one way, shape, or form. So these are just a few having to do with debt. But the takeaway here is, if you owe something, you need to pay it. And give to Caesar what is Caesar's. Pay taxes. So why is that? Well, I think part of it is, what good are we in jail? Quite frankly, I mean, what good are we in jail? We can protest paying taxes, but we don't pay taxes, good chance we're going to end up in jail and do nobody any good. Remember, they wanted Jesus to free themselves from the Romans, but that's not who he was really there for. We'd love to be freed of taxes, but so far that's just not the way it is. I know there is a cash economy out there. People avoid taxes through cash. I would just say be careful. The federal government has budgeted hiring 87,000 IRS agents. They're not going to all be going after billionaires. They're going to be going after the cash economy. So if you're self-employed in cash and not paying your taxes the way you should, I just caution you. Because a lot of times I know people who have went 15 years, and of course they're talking about, yeah, I don't pay any taxes. This is how I do it. Until they get caught. And then they look back. And if they find evidence of fraud, they look back even further than the 7 years. Next thing you know, you could find yourself in jail. So pay Caesar what is Caesar's. Don't try to avoid it. Don't be looking over your shoulder. You know, you carry that with you if you're doing something that you know you shouldn't be doing. And I don't like paying taxes, but I don't want to look over my shoulder. So when it comes to debt, I think we need to, relationships are more valuable than money. So when we take into account, like, are we going to lend to, let's say, friends and family, just be careful that there could be a relationship component to that. You're taking a risk. You could impact the relationship. There's a scripture that says, do not charge your fellow Israelite usury, which is interest. I interpret that to mean that don't charge your family interest. Don't profit from lending to your family. Now, who is your family? Well, to me, your family is your real blood family. It could also be your church family. So it's just something to take under advisement. I know when I've done personal loans, I never charge interest. Dave Ramsey has a pretty hard line, very conservative view of debt. He basically says you shouldn't have any. And he's really talking even mortgages and everything. And I say that's good. There's nothing ever bad about not having debt. But there are potentially times when there are good debt. And I just want to give you some examples of what that might be. Yes.
Something that someone shared with me as far as lending to friends and family to help save the relationship. They said, let's say I say, Ryan, can I borrow $1,000? I'm behind or whatever. And Ryan says, sure. And I say, oh, I'll pay you back in 3 months. You'll have everything paid back. But the wise thing to do is in your heart say, okay, I'm going to give this as a gift. Even though we've decided, we've talked about it, we've decided, okay, this is the payment plan, this is how it's going to get returned. But to save relationship and to make sure you don't have any hard feelings, you in your heart, you say, okay, even if I never get this money back, I'm not going to hold it as a grudge against this person. And that was a really good piece of advice that I got, because we've had experiences with family members and things, and it's really helped. So I just wanted to throw that out there with something that I thought about.
I know when we have lent to family, they say what they're willing to pay back. And we say, that's great. Okay. I hope so. But I'm doing what you're doing, which is if they miss the payment, if they're late, you know, I'm not calling them, where is it? Like I would maybe a tenant, you know, got a business and running rentals, right? You know, you're late 2 months, you're going to have to, what are you going to do? But it's good not to sacrifice a relationship. And I wouldn't lend to friend and family unless I was willing to not have that money paid back. I mean, that's just, I've also found my personal experience is it can still bring wedges to your relationship. If that person has a difficulty paying you back or they know they're late, my experience is they won't show up. You won't see them. Now, I don't recommend it as a way to get rid of your in-laws is to lend them money. And then when they owe you and they are behind, they won't show up and, you know, they go away. I wouldn't do it with that's a little facetious. But I have seen people stay away because they owe you money. Even though you may have grace and even though you're not asking for it, but, and I have seen people resent you because they owe you money. Even though you lended money to them, there are people that, just human nature, they resent the fact that they had to ask for it. They may resent the fact that they're not able to pay it back. And even though you did them, in theory, a good deed, they may focus the resentment on you when you didn't do anything really wrong, but just be aware you're taking those risks in relationships when you do that. I talked a little bit about, say, good debt. When can there be good debt? And I want to talk a little bit in business about risk versus reward. If you're a businessman, you're successful if you do things where the risk-reward ratio is a good investment. It's not no risk, because if you look for business opportunities with no risk, then you won't do any business. You'll do nothing. So you have to accept some risk, but it's the good ratio. Low risk, medium reward. Low risk, high reward, that's even better. High risk, medium reward. Not a good business decision. Avoid that. High risk, high risk. High risk, high reward. I'm conservative. I wouldn't do that either. I don't do option trading. A lot of people do. I don't sell short. I don't buy on margin. I don't do those things. To me, they're higher risk. Higher reward, too, if you're right. But just remember, what one of the things that debt does is it leverages whatever you're doing. It makes good things better, and it makes bad things worse. A risk-reward that I think is a good model, and I've used this to build up rentals, is typically it's not too hard to buy a rental property that'll return, say, 10%. Of its purchase price as net income every year. Now it's even better than that. And if you can buy it with 20% down with your own money and borrow 80% from the bank, you'll get 10% return on your 20% cash. But if you're borrowing at 4%, that other 80%, these are all numbers. I don't want them. But just bear with me a little bit. You're returning 10% on someone else's money. You're borrowing at 4 and you're getting 10. So you're making 6% on the bank money and on 4 times as much as your own money. So on that 20%, I'm making my 10%, and then I'm making 4 times the 10% minus the 4 that I'm paying back to the bank. I'm making 6 times 4 is 24 plus 10. I'm really making 34% return on that 20% of my cash. Now, do I want to do one property at 100% cash? I would get 10% return. And I would have no risk. I would have no debt. I would have no exposure. So that's the lowest risk business, but it turns 10% of my money. I can take that same amount of money at 20% down, and I could buy 5 houses at 20% down, right? Same amount of cash, and then I would be getting 34% return instead of 10. But I've got 5 houses to manage. I've got 5 times as many tenants. Every tenant's a risk. Every tenant's a potential vacancy. So, I mean, it's not without risk, but is your risk-reward ratio something? So debt, just being debt doesn't make it bad. But you need to be aware of all the risks. And sometimes the risks aren't what you think they are, and you may be unforeseen. And I think the best illustration is, I want to use a true story, because sometimes these stories you remember. I just told you a bunch of little numbers. You probably forget all that. But just remember 10% versus 34%. A good thing, it levers you, but it could be bad. Let's say right now, I can't get that 4% mortgage on that rental property. Right now, it's more like 9. I just saw today the 30-year fixed rate is now 8%. So I'm sure a rental, you know, 9% would be pretty good. A 10% return with 9% going back to the bank, that's only 1% margin. That's probably not worth, it's not worth the risk. I'd say right now that risk reward isn't. I don't want that 10% property. I can't buy it now and leverage it like I could it when it was 4%. Or the risk reward, that extra 1% in theory could easily get eaten up because you got 5 times as many houses to manage. That 1% is not enough margin. Wouldn't do it. I probably wouldn't even do it at 7%. You know, so, but 4%, I like the 34% return. But let me use an example of debt sneaking up and biting you. This is a real story. This is back in the 80s. There was a farmer. He was running, say, $40,000, $50,000 a year negative on his cash flow farming. He inherited a couple hundred acres debt-free, free and clear. So he was financing that $40,000 to $50,000 a year negative cash flow by putting debt against his land. Okay? This has been going on for a long time. This farmer didn't farm enough acres, really, to justify, like, buying a brand new combine. You know, but he did, and he drove it in the parade, and, you know. But he had negative cash flow every year, year after year. And he financed it out of the equity in his land. It was free and clear. Well, come the mid-80s, I believe, I think farmland was around $4,000 an acre, and he had accumulated debt of almost $2,000 an acre. But he still had 50% equity. Business as usual. You know, next year I'm going to buy my seed, I'm going to do it, and I'll just go to the bank. They'll give me the money I need, and I'll finance my lifestyle, and, you know, I'm losing 50 grand a year, but that's okay. I still have 2,000 an acre left. Well, and then it crashed. The value of farmland went from about 4,000 an acre down to less than 2,000 an acre in less than a year. So what do you think happened? Now the banks who look at when he goes to ask for the loan again, they look at it and says, you don't have any equity in your land anymore. In fact, it might even be negative. You may owe more than what we could sell the land for, so we certainly aren't going to be loaning you any more money. So that spring came. He couldn't get the money to put seed in the ground. So now he's got to fight to how do I get out from under this? He's let that debt accumulate, and it looks safe until things turn around. So what did he do? Well, he put the land up for auction, trying to get out from under it. I think he got close to 2,000 an acre, just about what the bank was owed. He got out from underneath the debt. But his way he operates, he was still in a negative 50,000 a year environment, and he had no way to fund it. So he paid off his debt and sold land, but kept struggling for a few more years with this negative cash flow. He just couldn't get around it. And then when he came to me, it's like, oh my gosh, why did you do this? You know, if we could got out of this earlier, or if we'd done these other things differently. One of the things he didn't realize is that, I mean, his only solution was eventually bankruptcy, okay. But a lot of people don't realize that when you go bankrupt, you wipe out a lot of things, a lot of debt. But you don't wipe out things like government loans. You don't wipe out anything you owe to the IRS. Bankruptcy does not clear that. So since he had received his land free and clear, his cost basis for tax purposes was zero. He sold it for $2,000 an acre. The IRS looked at that as capital gains of $2,000 an acre, and they assessed him a tax bill. He couldn't pay. He went bankrupt and still had these debts hanging over him that wouldn't go away. So I don't want to scare anybody about debt, but it seemed innocent. It seemed like he had plenty of cushion. He had 50% equity a year earlier. And then things changed, and it wasn't enough. And that debt leverage bit him. I asked a guy in California once, just another story. I was saying, how in the world can you afford this $1.2 million, 800 square foot house in a neighborhood that's got bars on the windows? Yeah, it makes no sense. A lot of things in California don't make sense to me. But how can you even make these payments? Well, I don't even know if these loans are legal anymore, but real estate values in California were just going up by leaps and bounds every year. 10%, 15%, year after year after year. Banks were lending people reverse amortization loans. I don't know if you ever heard of interest-only loans, which you're not paying off the principal at all, you're just paying the interest, get your payments down. Well, these loans got your payments down even more because your principal balance is going up. And the banks were willing to do it because they were banking on their real estate continuing to appreciate fast enough where the banks would be covered. Well, guess what happened when that turns around? Banks become upside down. the person who's been paying 10 years of payments now owes almost 1.5 times what his original principal is on a house, and now the values have went up a lot from when he bought it, but not enough to cover the balance that he's let accumulate. So now they're underwater. You'll hear this word a lot in finance, underwater. For homeowner means simply that your mortgage balance is higher than what the house is worth. And it's happened quite a few times. I don't know if you heard about the financial crisis of 2008. And here's where I'm going to get on the government a little bit. They really caused it. They caused it. They caused it because they thought it was a good idea. Everyone should own a house. So they relaxed the banking requirements so that almost anyone would qualify for a mortgage. You didn't have to have, you know, that down payment. You didn't have to have the credit rating. You didn't have to have that income to your payment ratio. They let lots of people take mortgages out. Shouldn't have had them. So what happens a few years after that? Well, these people aren't making their payments. Nobody could see that one coming. And next thing you know, there's a big crisis because of all these foreclosures. Then what happens? All these foreclosures are happening, and then all these houses go on the market for cheap. House prices crash. And it makes even the people who weren't in trouble, people who had 20% down payment and regular mortgages, now all of a sudden the price of the houses went down 40%. So they're underwater. They lost their 20% down payment and they're underwater. In 2010, Tammy and I bought a house in Arizona. We thought it was going to be our retirement home. It's 2010, 2 years after 2008. We bought it for 60% of what the people bought it for in 2006, when it was brand new. We bought it for 60%. They had paid 20% down. They lost it all. And the bank lost 20%. It was called a short sale. That's when you buy a house for less than what the bank is owed. And the bank allows it because that's the market. Or they can just sit on the house for who knows how long. Now here's another thing that people don't realize is that people owned a house ahead of us. They got transferred back to the East Coast. They had to buy another house with their company. So they lost their down payment. The bank had to write off 20%. And then here's the real kicker. That 20% that the bank wrote off counts as income to them. The IRS looked at that as income. They didn't get any cash, but it's income. They got a big tax bill now, and they don't have their down payment. Okay, and they were just doing what was normal in the market at that time because everybody was doing it. It's just what the prices were, but then they weren't. Then they collapsed. So when you're taking debt in a market, you've got to be aware of markets go up and down. If there's one thing the stock market's taught me lately, it goes up and down a lot. And just when, you know, recently, how much have real estate prices went up? Prices, houses. I bought a house in 2017. I held it for 5 years. 5 years. I sold it for almost twice in 5 years. Okay, now, today, the housing market, you would think with these high interest rates, it'd be collapsing, right? Prices haven't really come down very much. You know, why is that? Well, the number of buyers has dropped off a lot because of the high interest mortgages. But the number of sellers has also dropped off almost as much because if you're sitting there with a 2.5%, 30-year mortgage, I don't want to sell and then have to take out an 8% mortgage. So nobody's selling. It's just keeping the prices up temporarily because this is something in finance. The price on any given day for anything, it has nothing to do with its true value. Now, that doesn't make any sense, does it? The price has nothing to do with its true value. The price on any given day is a function of how many buyers and how many sellers in that market. If there aren't enough buyers, there are more sellers than buyers, the price goes down until the number of sellers equals, until they come together. Until they come together, the market's going to keep moving. And you can see these huge swings in values. You can see values get extremely distorted. Now, I'm looking at that. That's an opportunity. If I see the buyers and sellers out of whack to the point where the prices go way, way under what the true value is, I might just become a buyer. Same thing with being a seller. I've seen stocks get popular. They just get popular. Everyone wants to do crypto. We're going to make a fortune in crypto. And everybody gets in. And if you get in at the right time, and it just keeps going up and it looks great. Intrinsic value of crypto, in my mind, is zero. That's I don't do it. I don't do things I don't understand. I don't understand crypto. But I know a lot of people made a lot of money in crypto, and a lot of people lost a lot of money in crypto. Those numbers don't mean anything. They're not really tied to anything. Now, what's your house worth? I mean, there's a value there, but it can vary a lot year to year depending on what the market is, the number of buyers and sellers, the financial situation. And there's an overarching financial situation dictated to us that we can't really control, and that's kind of our government. And depending on what they want to do and what the policies are, they can greatly influence the prices on things. They can greatly influence whether an investment turns out to be good or bad. I mean, I'd like to know what their policies are going to be. I don't think they don't know what their policies are going to be, you know, next week. We don't even have a house yet with a speaker. you know. So we can't even pass any rules right now. So maybe that's good. Maybe the longer that happens, the better off we are. I don't know. Some people think gridlock is the only thing that saves us. But when we look at government, I don't know if anybody happened to look at that website that I gave you all. I know it's not something I'm going to run out. It's not exciting. It's not like a video game or anything. You're not going to go home and be entertained by it. It's just a bunch of numbers. But usdebtclock.org. So many real numbers in there, numbers the government doesn't want to tell you. They're public, but they don't want to bring it to your attention. They don't want you to know how bad off we really are fiscally with the federal financing. I shared a couple numbers with the federal side, you know, with you all, you know, last week a little bit. They haven't gotten any better this week. Guess what? They keep getting worse every single week. But when you look at the federal budget, 26% of the federal budget goes to Medicare and Medicaid. 21% goes to Social Security. That's almost half of the total budget right there. And everyone considers that that's untouchable. Let me tell you right now, it's not. Time's coming. They aren't going to have any choice. 12% is right now going on interest on the debt. And this is what they don't tell you. That's 12% this year. I don't know what that number is going to be next year, other than a lot higher. We have just come out of, I don't know how many years, of low interest debt that government has made available to people. Cheap money. They've made this cheap money available to us because because partly when they offer up the debt for sale, remember the price depends on how many buyers and sellers. So they're going, selling their debt. They're also going out and buying it to make it artificially lower than it should be and what it really would be. And then you, the taxpayer, are buying a government security that pays no interest. That's a good investment, right? You think, you want to use my money? I don't want to use our money that way. But it makes the interest rate artificially low. Never should have been that low. They're using it to stimulate. Now they're doing the opposite. They're trying to control inflation. I got news for you. There's no way around. You give away money, it's inflationary. You print money, it's inflationary. They got a $2 trillion deficit. They're spending $2 trillion more this year than what they're taking in. And they're going to have to go to the debt markets and sell debt. And guess what? They're not in a position to buy it. So it's going to be at the real market price. And right now it's approaching 5%. And it's approaching, and hopefully this isn't too hard to grasp, but it's not only that they have to sell debt for the $2 trillion deficit. They're continually refinancing the $33 trillion. Because whatever securities they've sold to finance that $33 trillion in treasuries, they have all kinds of treasuries. They have one-year treasuries, five-year treasuries, 10-year treasuries, 30-year treasuries. Last year, they were financing a lot of the debt with one-year treasuries. Guess what? They got to refinance them now at 5%. Why were they not selling 30-year treasuries when it was cheap? So we don't have to refinance that for 30 years. Why weren't they doing that? Banks? That's the answer, banks. That would crush the banks if they did that. If the banks were holding a 30-year 0% notes right now, that's what caused the banking crisis in March. There's a little banking crisis. I don't know if you're aware of it. Silicon Valley Bank went under. Some Republic Bank went under. There's a few banks went under. And it was because they had long-dated treasuries, which at 5%, when your note's paying you 0.5%, is severely discounted if you have to sell it. And if your depositors, who you were paying nothing, are now leaving you to get 4% somewhere, you might have to sell this treasury at a big loss. Just cover the cash flow, and then it bankrupted the bank. Okay. Bank people are supposed to be smart. They're managing billions of dollars. Silicon Valley Bank was $200 billion something, which in the scheme of things is actually tiny. In the big scheme of things, it's tiny. Another thing that came out in the banking crisis is, well, they want to say, oh, are the depositors going to get insured? Are they going to get covered? A lot of their depositors had more than the $250,000 that's FDIC insured. Now, I don't want to scare you with this, but FDIC insurance, that fund has 1.1% of the U.S. deposits in it. 1.1%. So if you're behind the dike and there's two fingers worth of little leaks, it'll work. It'll plug it. It avoided the bank crisis in March from getting bigger. They were able to plug a few leaks and it didn't snowball. If it's anything big, they can only cover 1.1% of your deposits. They call it insurance. It's kind of like don't get sick insurance. You know, it's kind of like we'll pay your co-pays, you know, up to $500. But if you have something major, no, can't cover that. Anything big happens in our financial world, FDIC insurance isn't worth anything. And if you look at, even if they do pay you back, it's going to be years from now, years and years, if they ever pay you back. Don't want to scare you, but you don't really have insurance. Don't count on that. So these backdrops don't give us a good warm and fuzzy about debt, does it? So when we're thinking about making a debt decision, you know, we should realize that house prices are fairly high priced right now. And they're only high priced because nobody's selling. That could change. So just be aware. And I feel sorry for young people because it's like, I want a house. I don't want to rent. You know, I want a house. I want to buy a house. And my recommendation to buying a house is, I don't know hardly anybody. I never could have bought a house without taking a mortgage out. I mean, you know, got to take a mortgage out to buy a house. But be careful making your decision to buy a house. Number one, real estate is not what we call illiquid investment, which means you can't just cash it in tomorrow. It takes time, and there's large transaction costs, realtors, inspections, fixes, time, loan origination fees, appraisals, you know, all these kind of things. Thousands of dollars usually, transaction cost. So before you buy a house, number one, make sure you're going to be there. I'd say 3 to 5 years minimum. Because you've got to move right away. You've got all those transaction costs. I mean, you know what it's like with a vehicle. You go to the dealer, you get your ride. If you decide a month later you don't like it, or more realistically, I'll say your wife decides she don't like it, and then you got to trade in for something else, well, you're going to lose money on that, right? I mean, it's transaction. Real estate's the same thing, but just bigger numbers. Transactions. So not everybody should have a house. The banking crisis in 08 said, you know, if you can't really afford a house, they shouldn't lend you the money. They're not doing you a good deed, because those people ended up with the foreclosure, ruined credit, plus whatever down payment they did have, maybe less than a normal one, but they still lost it all. It didn't do them any favors. So when it comes to debt, there is a lot to think about. But there can be good debt. Risk reward. You know, there are cases. But probably the best thing from Dave Ramsey for most people to help build your positive cash flow, probably the easiest thing under your control, not the easiest, but doable, is look at your debt. I don't know what kind of job you have, but you maybe can't just go out and get a raise. You know, I don't know, pounding on the boss's desk, it doesn't work too well. Never worked for me, I don't know. But look at your debt. And interesting, Dave Ramsey came up with which debt do you pay off first? Well, first of all, let's talk about credit card debt. If you're carrying a balance on credit cards, the interest rates are just too high. That's the first thing you've got to get rid of, any credit card debt. You can't carry a balance on credit cards. Interest rates are too high. They eat you up, but it just chews you up. Now, it's easier said than done. You know, I know, depending on your personal situation. I mean, it can be substantially different for people. Everyone has their own place in life. It's interesting that And when we look at these death situations and we look at the U.S. government, my heart goes out to young people. Because who's going to pay this? Our children and our grandchildren. And yet the young people in our society have an entitlement mentality that they want this stuff. They want their student loans forgiven. They want to have everything that someone else has worked 40 years for right now. They want all these things, and the government can buy their vote by trying to give it to them. They're the ones that are going to pay for it. But they don't see it. They don't see it. And I feel, you know, my heart goes out to that. The financial environment today for young people, it's kind of scary. If you look at pensions are not as common as they used to be. They're not near as good as they used to be. Most places of employment don't even offer a pension other than maybe a 401k. I see I don't have a whole lot of time left, but the best thing on your cash flow is try to get to a positive cash flow. If you're running up your credit card balances to finance a negative cash flow position, it's kind of like what that farmer was doing that I was talking about earlier. It's not going to end well. In fact, the longer you let it keep going without doing something about it, you're going to stress yourself out, and everyone who has a relationship with you is going to pay the price too, your spouse, whoever. And whenever you're sitting down trying to come up with a financial plan, husbands and wives do it together. You can't do it in secret. You can't do it by yourself. You got to be on the same page. I did leave some cards out there. If anybody wants to email me for, I'm retired, so I can make my time available. Because personal situations are unique, and the solution is probably unique. And obviously, we can't this form. You can't cover all those things. But reducing debt is probably the biggest thing you should initially look at. And the first debt you want to pay off, it's not, other than credit cards, you got to get rid of those. But the next one is the shortest term debt. May not be the highest interest, but it's the shortest term. And that doesn't make sense from a spreadsheet standpoint, just pure math. But the reason for that is it'll have the most impact that you will see where you've improved your cash flow balance. And it's just kind of like a diet. You need some confirmation to give you the discipline to stick with it. So paying off the shortest term debt will have the biggest impact on your cash flow, and you probably need to see that. And like I think I mentioned it with Jesse's question last week, set up a wealth accumulation account so that as you increase your positive cash flow, you move it out of your regular checking account so you can't see it. Or in my case, so my wife can't see it. It's interesting. I'll tell her, oh, how many people do you have at lunch today? She said, what? At Olive Garden. What? I see the credit card. I see what's on. I know that's not one person, you know. But but, you know, another thing, and I think we're not going to get through it all today, but is, I'll start getting into it a little bit, but it's taxes. Now, taxes is, the more successful you are, the bigger deal it is. The more you make, the more the tax. Almost 50% of taxpayers in this country, I'm using the word loosely here. 50% of households in the country do not pay income tax. You know, part of that is because, you know, there's 27,700 married filing jointly standard deduction. which means you can make that much and pay no tax, federal income tax. About half the households don't pay any federal income tax. But the taxes we pay, it's huge. The FICA tax, or Social Security, 7.5% of your check. For the person making their first dollar, there's no standard exemption on that. You're paying 7.5%, and your employer's paying 7.5%. And if you're self-employed, you're paying 15%. And that's dollar one. There's no exemption. So, on the income tax, it's what they call progressive. The more you make, the more you pay. And there's a chunk of people who don't pay income tax. But there's plenty of other taxes for everyone to pay. Sales tax is 7.25, 7.5. I mean, it depends what county you're in. 7.5% there. State, it's running 3-6%. Graduate again progressively. Property tax, if you own your home, you're going to be paying property tax. Most of that goes to fund the schools. And then you have municipal taxes. Like I know when I lived out in the country in Riverdale, they had a 1% school tax. I worked in Findlay. I had to pay 1% tax because I worked in Findlay. So, I mean, it all adds up. But I guess one of the things, so I'm really running out of time, but what I'll talk about next time is 401ks, IRAs, both conventional and Roth, how you can use what your employer makes available to you. One of the don'ts is when you change companies and you get a 401 payout, more people than not take that distribution. You should roll it over. I know so many people take that distribution. Well, you're going to pay the penalty, and it's going to count toward your income tax. And it's going to be a little nest egg you were building, and then you're going to have to start over. So, I mean, that's one thing I'll just say right now. Don't, you know, if you're changing jobs, roll that 401 over to your new job. And if the new job doesn't offer it, you can roll it into an IRA. I guess the next thing, and I guess we're going to have to quit, Jesse, to be on time, but insurance. You got health insurance, it's a big one. House, car, and older people, long-term care insurance. There's things to think about there. Estate planning, wills, trusts. We just went through a couple funerals of people with no wills, no arrangements, and it's very stressful on the family. It's very stressful on the siblings. It's very environment for people to argue. It's all kinds of things. So, I mean, wills are important. I mean, you don't have to have a lot of money to make a will an important thing to do. So, work-life balance, you know, other things. So, that's a prelude to, I guess, next week. Definitely be done next week. I promise. We didn't get much mic activity today. I don't know if that's a good thing. Probably not a good thing. But do you want to? Yeah, I'm done. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, praise the Lord. So again, this is a stewardship series, and it's different than what we normally do, but we feel like it is very needed for the church to understand every aspect of stewardship. As the church, we really push spiritual stewardship. Courage is our relationship with God. But this is another important aspect of it. Like we talked about, there are over 2,000 verses in the Bible that deal with money and possessions, and God put it that way so that we would understand how important it is for us to steward what He's given us well. The next stewardship topic we're going to be discussing is time management. So if you're a procrastinator or you have trouble scheduling or managing your time, you'll definitely want to be here for that. My wife told me I'm so good at procrastinating, I went pro. I am a procrastinator, all right? Something that God is working out of me. But I want to encourage you, come back next week. This is all practical information, and I know some of it, he's giving us information for every aspect of our financial situation or every place of our financial situation. So it doesn't matter if you're just starting out, if you're middle life, if you're in retirement, there are things that we can glean from all of this. So, you know, if you're at a place where you're like, man, I'm not getting any of this, that's okay, because your neighbor might be. And someday you might just need to reach back in your file and pull out that information and be like, Jerry told me that 10 years ago and I didn't pay any attention. Well, now we're getting it. Okay? So, like I said, there was other areas about taxes that you might think is boring, but it might be speaking to somebody who may not be paying their taxes. So God is using Brother Jerry to plow up some ground that I believe has been hard for a long time, and God is doing some good things through it. Amen? All right, did we have any prayer requests from Facebook, or if there's any prayer requests in the building, by the raising of your hand, we'll just go ahead and dismiss in prayer. Heavenly Father, we just give you thanks, God, that you are a good God. I thank you for everyone who's here, God, everyone who's going to watch this, God. I just pray that you would enrich our lives through stewardship, God, enrich our relationship with you, continue to teach us to be good stewards of what you've given us. God, I pray for a safe travel home, that you would bless each family and bless each home. In Jesus' name we thank you. Amen.